Hi everyone, and welcome back to Murder in the North. I'm Kelby.
And I'm Zach.
And before we get into this week's episode, we just want to take a moment and wish everyone a happy Valentine's Day. And before you get ready to listen to Zach's case this week, grab your fellow true crime lover and get comfy for Zach's case.
Before we get into the episode, we did notice that some spots are a little echoey after we edited it, so we did just want to kind of let you know we are just still trying to figure out the settings for everything, but hope to have it all set up by next week. So our case sources this week is Canadian Crimepedia, Murderpedia, and a YouTube video called Crime Stories. So I'm not going to say what the title of the YouTube video is, just because it is going to give it away, but it will be in the show notes just under the description. So to get into it, our case takes place today actually in two different Canadian cities, being London, Ontario, and Guelph, Ontario.
Oh, not too far.
Yeah, and we've got some history in both cities. So Doris Brown was 49 years old, living on her own with her daughters for the first time in 30 years, after a recent divorce with her husband. Her daughters were Laura and Colleen Brown. In August of 1974, it was a day before Laura's 16th birthday. Laura and Doris were home while Colleen was actually at a family friend's. It was a normal night, getting ready for the next day as she was turning 16, and Laura and Doris were waking up early so they could actually go to the DMV so she could actually get her learner's permit. So they went to bed, and the next morning, Laura woke up and felt like they'd actually like slept in. Like, you know, you kind of wake up, you're like, I should have already been awake by now.
Right.
So she woke up kind of with that feeling. And when she kind of fully woke up and kind of came to, she realized that her mom's alarm was going off.
Oh.
And this was not like Doris. Doris would always wake up for her alarm. She wouldn't just kind of leave it going and just keep sleeping. She's not like me. So, like, at this time, Laura kind of knew things were a little suspicious, so she went into her mom's room. And when she first went into her mom's room, she knew that something wasn't right. So she walked in and just kind of started to try and kind of wake her up, just kind of standing at the door, just kind of talking to her mom. And at this point, it was a hard point for her to kind of walk over there because she didn't have a good feeling. But she walked over, and that's when she realized that Doris was dead. So she called her aunt and her uncle frantically, and when they got there, it looked as if Doris just died of natural causes. They thought to check her sleeping pills, thinking that she may have overdosed on them, but they were actually still full, and nothing was moved in the room, and nothing was broken, and there was no signs of like a forced entry.
For some reason, I have a feeling I know this case, but I can't think of it. But everything, and the look you're giving me right now,
makes I hope
me
you don't.
Feel like I might know this case.
So, when they actually finally moved Doris's body, the paramedics saw that there was a little bit of blood on the bed, but this actually wasn't relayed to the police at all. So, a couple days later, Laura would meet with the doctor, who would actually tell her that there was really no cause of death. It was almost as if she is like similar to like a crib death, which is normal in babies under 12 months who just die in their sleeps with no warning or signs.
Yeah, SIDS.
Yeah.
So she would have been found dead on the day of her daughter's 16th birthday.
Yep, by her daughter.
Oh, jeez. But wasn't the other daughter at her friend's?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so she wasn't there. This really wasn't out of the ordinary. In fact, a year earlier, there was a student named Mary Hicks that was found in her apartment. And it was assumed that she actually died due to an allergic reaction with a prescription that she was on. Because similar to Doris, there was no forced entry, nothing at all. It was just as if she passed away in her sleep.
We have a serial killer on our hands. I can sense it.
A month after was when Alice Ralston's body was found, who had also looked as if she passed away in her sleep. But this time, they noted down the cause of death as hardened arteries, which is essentially occurs when fat, cholesterol, and other substances build up in the walls of your arteries. These deposits are called plaques, Over time, these plaques can narrow and completely block the artery.
That sounds painful.
It kind of does sound like it would be painful. But 4 months later, Eleanor Hartwick was also found in very similar circumstances as Doris, and she looked tranquil, even still had the book that she was reading before bed resting near her head. And I bet at this point you're wondering, with all of these deaths looking as natural causes, simply, why are we talking about them? Around this time, the police in Southern Ontario would have thought the same, because they all looked like passings of natural causes. Wasn't enough to raise suspicion, as 4 women in 1 year died due to natural causes. So this was until December of 1974. Diane Betts was on a 2-week vacation from work and was spending it with her boyfriend James. And the day before New Year's, James would actually propose. And the next day was kind of just a normal day for them. James and Diane woke up for breakfast, and James got ready and left for work around 5:45 a.m. And around 10:30 in the morning, somebody would call the police, similar to kind of near her apartment, just to really report a stolen suitcase. And around 6 p.m. is when James got home, and he started looking for Diane, and it was almost as if she just wasn't there. And then he made it to their bedroom, and he would find her body and immediately call police. Her hands were tied with pantyhose, and a brassiere was tied around her neck. But police were intrigued by the fact that there was no signs of a forced entry either. No signs of a struggle, and it was almost as if she just knew the attacker and let them in, but was actually weakened by like a drug.
So does this have something to do with the stolen suitcase that the police were phoned about?
We're gonna get there.
Okay, because I'm like, that's kind of a weird thing to say and then just jump. Okay.
It is a weird thing, but you'll see. Police start talking to the neighbors, and they start to hear a pattern of a brown car that was actually in the parking lot or between 4 to 8 a.m., and the engine was running. Police start searching for the brown car. They look through thousands of registries, but none are related to any of her family or acquaintances. And within a 3-week period, over 200 people were interviewed and fingerprinted.
So, at this time, did the police think that this murder had been related to any of the other murders? Like, did they link it at any point and say, you know, these are all pretty similar?
So, the police at this time don't ever, all those other deaths that I mentioned at the start of this case, these are still listed as natural causes. So at this time, this was actually the first murder
that was kind of a little bit more,
yeah, this I was like the first one that, yeah, that they could really see the signs for. Right. So one that wasn't really looked into was the report of a stolen suitcase. So that one was, so it was reported, but they didn't really ever follow up with it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, they probably were more concerned about her being found.
Exactly. And things would actually quiet down for a couple of years until April of 1977.
A couple years?
So this was, that happened, the last murder was in 1974, and the next one was in 1977.
What? So yep. They just didn't follow up.
So at this time, there was still
they had, nothing. Like, no suspects. Nothing. Oh my god. Okay.
So, Louielle George worked as a cashier at a hospital. I actually didn't know that was a job until I actually was doing this.
Like, that maybe was in like the food department or something, like in the food court.
It was actually more so, like possibly in the food court, but also around, like, if they didn't have insurance. So, like, if they were traveling from another country, they do still have to pay.
Oh.
So, that's kind of what I got. That. Yeah, that's kind of what I got out of it. And the hospital at this time actually was right across the street from the apartment. And I'm actually going to touch on something here. It's a little random note. This was actually about 2 blocks down from an apartment we looked at. Yeah. One? One of the first ones, we didn't look at it because it was kind of sketchy.
In London?
Yeah.
There's a lot of sketchy apartment in London.
I know. It was one of the ones before we even, like, actually officially moved in together. I'll show
probably
it to you.
Probably on Richmond.
It actually wasn't.
No?
No. I remember where, but I can't think of the street.
Oh, you're
going
to have to show me. That's funny.
Yeah. So, but one day Louielle didn't show up for her shift, and the nurses actually got pretty concerned. So they got in contact with her landlord and went to go check on her. This is actually when they found Louielle's body. The forensics looked as if it was strangled, but no connection was actually made at this time because Diane's murder in 1974 was actually in Guelph and Louella's was actually in London. They're 120 kilometers away or 74 miles, and this is would actually take about an hour and 20 minute drive.
We know the drive.
We know the drive.
Drive.
This is more for the listeners. But these were similar. They were both strangled in their apartments. Both showed no signs of a struggle. Police weren't sure if the door had been just unlocked or if it was locked and they were let in because, frankly, there was no signs of a forced entry.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely someone they know. I can feel it.
Police would again interview the neighbors, but this time there was nothing. The only thing that would actually be found was two blocks away in an alleyway. They found a bag with jewelry, lingerie, and it was all just in a garbage can. And around this time, a lot of women started calling the police, making mysterious sightings after dark. So they would call them just saying, like, hey, like, I'm seeing figures in my room type of things.
What?
So, like, these were things that police would start to follow up on, and then it started to escalate into, now it was sexual assaults that were being called in.
So there was random people sneaking into apartments and, like...
So, in the sexual assault cases, they were saying that they actually had seen, like, a male figure run away. Out of the apartment after.
God. Could you imagine?
Mm-hmm. Seriously.
Oh, that scares me just hearing you say that.
So after this, there was actually another girl that was sexually assaulted and strangled and left to be dead, but would recover.
So she could probably identify who it was?
It was hard because it was always done in the dark.
Oh, in the dark.
So it was hard to really kind of get an idea.
I'm happy she's okay.
Yeah. But I believe she actually may have kind of given like a sketch, like a brief sketch of kind of like an idea of what he could have looked like. This is kind of when the police start to think, how can they be getting in? And then police start to think, what is the one door in a lot of apartment buildings that aren't locked? The balcony.
Oh my God. I didn't even think about that.
Neither did I.
And I'm just reflecting when we lived in the apartment. Ours was never locked.
We would wake up and ours would just be open because of Harley.
Yeah, because our cat would just like paw at the door to open it.
Yeah.
And we were... Someone could put a ladder there and they... Oh my God.
So then they kind of start looking at some of the cases and like some of the cases of how high... they would have had to go that I'll touch on actually.
Okay,
when
so
I get into it.
I have reflected and I don't know what this case is. I thought I did. I don't.
it's messed up. So when they kind of get this idea that it's going to be somebody who's possibly kind of scaling the side of a building, kind of one of their biggest thoughts is they must be like somebody athletic, of course, but also built like a bodybuilder. And it actually did kind of meet some of the cases, like some of the descriptions that some of the women would kind of describe them as a tall male who was very muscular, kind of strong because unfortunately in some cases he was overpowering them. So around this time, a lot of women would kind of just live on edge, and especially ones that are living alone. So some chose to kind of spend a lot more time with family and friends, especially in this case of Donna Veldboom. She recently finished her shift and would go to spend the night at her friend's house, who she recently met. Donna wasn't from Ontario. She actually recently moved from New Brunswick, and at this point was only in Ontario for just about under a year. Around 11:30, Donna would get ready to head home, as she had to work the next day. Around this time, in the same neighborhood, one lady actually got a buzz to her apartment saying I was an officer. This is actually when she made a very good decision and would actually call the police to confirm their identity.
That's really smart on her part.
I never would have thought of this.
No, I would have been panicking, just let them in probably.
Now that I'm reading these cases, 100% I'm thinking of this now.
Yeah.
And the police confirmed it was no one they knew.
So did police go over?
So I don't quite know if the police went over, but she could hear the man just start running away. The next day, Donna Veldboom wasn't at work. So friends started to kind of worry and called the police. They would end up finding Donna. Just as the last two murders, she was strangled, but this time it was different because she was actually stabbed. This is when police knew that the killer was starting to escalate and knew that it was one person. Like, all of the murders were all tied together. As strangulation was the common denominator, but also cleanliness. Before he left their apartments, he would make sure that everything was in place, and in some cases actually wash their dishes.
I mean, that's kind of nice, but he just murdered them. That's morbid.
So, in the case of Donna, he actually washed her chest where he stabbed.
Oh my god, this guy's messed. Well, I'm assuming it's a guy.
Just a second. In the cloth that he used to wash her chest with, he would actually clean it in the laundry in the apartment's common area.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
Could you imagine?
Seriously.
Oh my gosh.
So now is kind of getting to the point that police are starting to walk the streets and look for literally anybody who kind of matched a brief description that they were provided. Someone tall, strong, and possibly a bodybuilder. There were 30 officers working night and day, and in the YouTube video they mentioned that they were staying at the at their office for sometimes up to 3 days at a time. This was the biggest manhunt in London's history. And the worst part is they had very little clues to go on. But this is actually when they were about to make a very big discovery. When checking neighbors of victims and kind of cross-checking with their criminal records, one officer noticed that there was one name that kept popping up. This being Russell Maurice Johnson. He was 30 years old. He was a tall and amateur weightlifter who worked at an auto factory. And this was actually around when Ford was still in St. Thomas. So I do believe that I saw a report that it was at Ford.
Oh my, so close to home.
I remember we used to drive past where the Ford used to be, and every time we drive by, that's where the Ford used to be.
You're mocking me on my podcast.
Police look back and see where the items were left in the trash can to see. It was actually a direct line from Luella's to Donna's apartment.
A direct line?
So it was as if he was actually living in Donna's apartment. He was a neighbor
they all died in apartments?
Yep.
Oh, yeah, I didn't realize that when you mentioned Donna. I thought they were in a house.
It was all apartments.
And no one in the apartment heard anyone. I feel like apartment neighbors are so nosy.
So this is when they started to look into Russell, just to kind of see his past. And this is actually where they would find that he had a history of sexual deviancy in the past and physical psychiatric treatment. So Russell had actually been interviewed as well, but do you remember when they reported that suitcase stolen?
Yes.
That was actually Russell.
Like, he was the one that called, or he was the one that stole it?
He was the one that called.
Sneaky. So was he trying to deter them from the murder?
We'll get there. And when they actually looked into the cars, he actually drove a very similar car to the one that was at the crime scene for Diane. This is when police knew that this was their man. But now they needed to find the evidence to properly convict him.
So at this point, did they bring him in?
So they, at this point in time, they had a strong feeling that it was him. All that they really had at this time was that he lived in their apartments.
Like more background information?
Yeah, as well as his car matched.
See, in my opinion, that's enough.
I would think that was enough too, for sure. So they started looking for more information. So this is actually when they started really watching him. The one thing that they would come to find was he was very passionate for cleaning. I actually read reports that he would actually, when he was at the gym and work, he would like put on like petroleum jelly and then put on gloves. He always wore gloves. Like it was almost like he was like a germaphobe.
Interesting.
While following Russell, they actually would start to notice a really weird behavior. He would drive around, stop someone somewhere random, like a corner of a street, stand there looking around as if he was looking for someone or something, would then make his way back to the car, sit in his car for a half hour or so, and then just drive off. And kind of around this time, they actually saw him in his house, and they saw him starting to kind of pack his things up as he was planning to go on a vacation. But for the police, they couldn't risk it because they don't know if he knows they're already on to him. So they don't know if he's just not going to come back. So they do what we thought they would have done already, and they take him in.
See, I thought you were going to say they had like a girl or something, and they were going to like play her as bait or something.
So it'll actually kind of, I'll touch on it in a second here. I don't want to give anything away yet.
But that's what I thought, that mm-hmm. when he was waiting at the corner and getting out, like that, to me, it's almost like he's looking for someone, like a next victim or something.
Yeah, and like that was like the weirdest thing to them was like, what are you looking for? And then the fact that he just sits in his car for 30 minutes and then just drives off. Like there was no one got in. He didn't talk to anyone, didn't pick up anything. It was just odd behavior. So they started interviewing Russell. The interview went for 22 hours with investigators.
Oh my God.
And after the 22 hours, the investigators came out because they were just exhausted. But this is when they could really start to see that he was starting to come around. They kept going until he finally broke down and would actually confess. He would talk about how he would get these urges to do something, and he wouldn't know what he was doing. When he was climbing the side of the apartments, he knew that he was doing it, but he wasn't sure how he was doing it.
And now I'm reflecting, did nobody see a man climbing the side of a building?
If I ever look at the side of a building and see someone, like, scaling the side of a building, I'm calling the police.
Or, like, I'm envisioning, like, a ladder or something like that. That would give yourself he away, didn't have a ladder. But real life Spider-Man.
So they would actually mention that he would pretty much stand on top of the railings, would reach up and pull himself up, and almost just do like a chin up to get up and do the same thing to the next one.
Very motivated individual.
Before I actually get back into it, I actually saw a report that the highest he got was 15 stories.
Oh my God. So make sure you lock your balcony doors, everyone.
Seriously. So in actually one case, he went back to the scene the next day. And he looked up to where he saw the police on the balcony. And he just looked up there in disbelief that he had done that. He confessed to the killing of Diane, Donna, and Luella. Donna being the only one that he had cut, he said it was because he was cold. And he just wanted to climb inside and stay warm. And for the cleaning, it was because he didn't want them to be mad at him. So he would do that to try and kind of help it.
Oh my God.
From what the lead investigator had to say, it seemed as if when they caught Russell, he was actually happy that he had been caught. Russell would be charged with 3 first-degree murder charges, and it wasn't long before he hinted at more.
Was he in the rooms?
Pardon?
Was he the one that was in the rooms?
Mm-hmm. Yep. So, they tried to get more out of him, but he wouldn't say anything. So this is actually when the Crown Attorney made a deal with Russell's lawyer that if he told them of the more, then he wouldn't actually be charged with them. Which is a little kind of weird to me, to be honest.
Yeah, I would hope they'd be bluffing.
He actually ended up just getting charged with them. So it was around this time that they actually would end up taking that because he just wanted to try and get it off of his mind. He actually took himself to a psychiatric hospital after he strangled and actually left her for dead, would stay there for a week before being let go. And during this time, nothing was reported to the police. I feel like that is something you almost have to report.
Yeah, well, especially if he confessed to killing someone, like, legally, they would have to report that.
Mm-hmm.
Unless he didn't say.
Possibility.
But if you are at risk of harming yourself or others, legally you have a duty to report that.
So, Russell would later confess to killing 4 other women, 2 in Guelph and 2 in London, the ones that we mentioned at the start. These were the women seen as died to natural causes, and Laura, Doris's daughter, would actually hear about the arrests and his confession and can't help but think if she had heard at something that night.
And I'm wondering why maybe he didn't know that she was home?
Maybe.
Or because she was, younger? He just...
Yeah, they said that his kind of age range was between around 20... early 20s to late 40s.
So did he drug the other girls?
No.
Just strangled or?
There was never details about how he did it. Yeah. So Russell altogether was responsible for 7 murders and 12 sexual assaults, making him one of the worst serial predators in Canadian history. So Russell went to trial in January of 1978 for the first-degree murders, and would be found not guilty for insanity.
Oh my, every time it's insanity.
So, when psychiatrists were in the courtroom, they would paint a picture of his sexual deviant with a mental disorder that had been deteriorating for years and would suffer from psychotic episodes where he loses his touch with reality. He would be sent to a mental facility in Penetang, where he's actually still here today, and is kept under a lock and key in their maximum security facility.
Oh my god. I can understand from the way you described it, he obviously was very unwell mentally.
Yeah.
But it's hard at the same time because he's unwell, but is that an excuse?
And that's it. It's
hard. It's really hard to distinguish.
When I kind of found out that he actually put himself into the hospital, I'm not going to lie, I was actually sad for him because he tried to get the help and... The system failed him. And then...
But how many people...
After.
Well, not only that, how many people he murdered and how many people he assaulted.
Oh, yeah.
And how their lives are probably affected to this day, right?
Yeah.
That's wild.
I told you it was a wild case.
Zach warned me during the week. He was like, I just want to tell you about my case. And I'm like, you can't.
It was one that we wanted to talk about. I wanted to talk about, but it was so hard to kind of keep it in.
And that's the worst part.
That's it. But that's the case of Russell Johnson.
Wow.
The bedroom strangler.
So how old is he now?
I believe is in his late 70s now.
Late 70s? Okay.
Yeah, because that would have been 78 was when he was tried and found, guilty because he literally cannot get out of the mental facility there.
And I guess, too, for listeners that are not from Canada, Canada does not have a life sentence. We don't do that here. So I'm sure most of you are probably thinking, well, why wasn't he sentenced to life in prison? That's not something that we have in Canada. But wow.
Yep.
Well, I feel there really isn't a good way to end this, but that is our episode for the week.
If you're not following us already, we do have an Instagram at Murder in the North Podcast. We also have TikTok, which is the exact same username, at Murder in the North Podcast. We'd love if you guys would consider rating our podcast, leaving a review, sharing it with other true crime fans. Each week we're growing and it's super exciting for Zach and I, kind of see, like, looking back and seeing the stats of how many people we have listening, not only with within Canada, but just global. So thank you guys so much for listening. We really, really appreciate it. And if you want a certain case covered, go to our Instagram. You can suggest a case there. But other than that, stay safe and we will see you on Tuesday.